Hello, everyone. Welcome to a new episode of Tech Can Save Us podcast brought to you by Literal Humans. As always, I'm Paul David, co-founder and CEO of Literal Humans, one of your co-hosts. I'll kick it over to my esteemed co-host.
Will Gadsby-Pete here, the other co-host of Literal Humans. If the audio quality is sounding a little lower than usual, it's because we're on the road, we're remote, we're not from our lovely Somerset House studio, so apologies if things aren't as crisp and clear as usual.
We are joined today by Ai-Jen Poo, president of National Domestic Workers Alliance and the director of Caring Across Generations. Welcome to the show, Ai-Jen.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm excited.
And where are you calling in from today?
Chicago, Illinois, right in the middle of the country.
Nice one. Well, I'm in Philly. That's my home, and Will's in London, so we've got a major basis covered here. So
that's right. That's pretty good. Pretty good coverage.
And is Chicago home for you, Ai-Jen?
It is. I spent most of my life in New York, but I moved here about a decade ago, so it's home.
Give our audience just kind of a high-level introduction of who you are and what you do, please.
Sure. So I'm an organizer, and I've spent 25 years organizing with women who work in the care economy, doing child care, aging and disability care, or cleaning, the work inside of our homes that supports our families and makes everything else possible in our lives and in the economy. And about a decade ago, a little over a decade ago, we at the National Domestic Workers Alliance, on the path to trying to make care and cleaning jobs good jobs, we found ourselves really reaching out to families who need care and family caregivers who are caring for their loved ones, and just realizing how undervalued and unsupported everyone is when it comes to care. And so we created this campaign together with a group called Jobs with Justice, called Caring Across Generations, that really is about bringing together the broadest possible coalition to change the way that we support caregiving in America. So that's everything from childcare to paid leave to aging and disability care, so that we can all have the support we need to live well.
Yeah, really appreciate the work that you're doing, and couldn't be more interestingly timed. I'm actually in Philadelphia because I help support my dad, who's elderly, and he's currently in a care home, and we're looking at other options like Veterans Administration home for him, and just care options. So yeah, the work that you do is so important to me and so many other families. So just a big thank you for what you're doing, because I think as carers, you know, sometimes it can feel very lonely and feel, you know, like you don't have support. So appreciate what you're doing at a very high level.
And the systems are so hard to navigate. You're in the thick of it, and it's just not designed for human usage. And, you know, people are coming to these systems in times of crisis and urgency and need. And it's just, it's not right. So my heart goes out to you, and if there's anything we can do to support you on your journey.
I appreciate that. Yeah, I was neck deep in like VA forms yesterday, and helped my dad renew his passport so he can come visit me in England. And then I was just like, let's just go to a movie. So we just went to a movie and took a break. And, you know, it's what you got to do.
Good for you. That is actually like a great caregiver practice of just being like, you know what? Let's just go to a movie. Forget it.
Well, let's jump in, as we do, as always, at the top of Tech Can Save Us, into the headlines. We shared a couple pieces with you that, and they're specific to the work that you do. And one of the pieces was from Occupational Health and Safety. And there were some staggering stats in this report about, you know, they did a survey and they showed that 51% of the respondents had received pressure from their employer to work in dangerous conditions. And, you know, around 85% of respondents described injuries, you know, that gave them chronic back, shoulder, arm and leg pain from the workplace. So just curious, in terms of the work that you do, how do you think technology specifically can be utilized to improve health and safety for domestic workers and all workers facing these sorts of conditions?
So I think technology is so powerful. And it's all about to what end it's being deployed to. And I know you talk about that a lot on this podcast. And, you know, when we think about how technology in this period has been utilized, it's really been about designing for kind of convenience and efficiency for a consumer. And it hasn't been designed to enhance the quality of work and life for workers. And so if it were deployed in that direction, miracles could happen. honestly. Like, if you, I don't know if you've ever seen this thing called the Hoyer lift, but it's basically like straight out of a Flintstones film. But it's a piece of technology that people have been using for decades to lift people who have limited mobility from a bed to a chair or into a wheelchair, or to move people around. It's meant to assist a home care worker, for example, in moving somebody who is challenged in terms of mobility and is too heavy for them to physically carry. But these machines literally are, they literally look like they came out of a Flintstones cartoon. They're so arcane. And I'm just sitting here wondering, like, thousands of workers are using this very piece of machinery every day. What if it were easy to use, more automated, and I mean, the efficiency that that could create would open up so much space for the home care worker to actually be more emotionally present and offer the unique thing that only a human being can offer, which is that emotional and human presence. So I just think the work that I'm constantly seeing every day in our workforce, there's so much that technology can offer to improve the conditions for workers and make the parts of the work that are very hard and strenuous a lot less so, and to open up the opportunity for people to do the parts of the work that are the most essential and the most unique to what humans can bring to the equation.
Bit of a cheeky follow-up. And first of all, I just want to appreciate one of the taglines that I think you had, and I've seen one of your talks where you talked about the work that makes all other work possible. Do I get that right?
That's right.
That's like such a beautiful turn of phrase. And I think it shows sort of the, I don't know how to put it, like, the importance, but the ubiquity, you know, of kind of the work that care workers do and how they form the foundation of society, really, if you think about it. And just appreciate that. The cheeky follow-up is this, just around, do you wish in the tech space people would stop developing just like a million, you know, food delivery apps and 50 bajillion types of deodorant and focus on some of the, you know, addressing some of the problems that care workers are facing in the workplace to make it safer, better? Like, do you see these products coming out and you're like, gosh, I wish we could just focus on problems that are more core to care workers?
Absolutely. 100%. I mean, there's so much talent that's being deployed towards a little bit better food delivery app experience. And I just think we need to deploy that talent, that creativity, that design logic, that sense and spirit of innovation to how we make life better for everyday people, working people, people who are doing the very best they can to contribute, to support their families, to make ends meet, and are just struggling in so many ways, basic ways. I mean, we're talking about being safe at work. This whole, you started the conversation with occupational safety and health. The fact that so many people are just at some basic level unsafe at work, like enduring harm just to contribute to the economy and support their families, that is ridiculous. And we should be able to solve for that.
There's a consistent theme with a lot of these articles of just like underappreciation of domestic workers. Like, you know, there's the being forced to work in an unsafe environment, which, as you say, is just like, you know, that's insane. Like, no other profession accepts that as a thing that you're going to have to go and work with dangerous substances with no gloves on for the rest of the week. It's mad. The next article we shared with you was looking at a report that of how the Low Pay Commission reported domestic workers receiving less than minimum wage and in poor working conditions, specifically in the UK. So I get, it's a two-part question for you. I mean, like, what can governments, countries and organizations like yourself do to fight this? And also, just why do you think there is just like this almost societal neglect of such a vital role, you know, like you said, the work that makes all other work possible? Like, what's gone wrong with us as a society that things have gotten so bad?
Well, you know, this work has always been associated with women, and as a profession, with women of marginalized social status. So in the US, Black women, immigrant women, Native women. And in fact, in the 1930s in the US, when we had this growing labor movement and a real push to establish a social contract that protected the dignity of work, the New Deal moment, there were two groups of workers who were excluded from the rights and protections of the New Deal and the promise it offered, frankly, of the American dream. And those two groups of workers were farm workers and domestic workers who were Black at the time. So it's part of a legacy in the US, at least, of slavery and racism, that these workers have been written out of protections that most people take for granted when they go to work every day. And that's been kind of the imprint of the treatment. And while every country is a different context, there is always a class or a caste system in place. It reflects hierarchies of power and privilege that shape everything about our lives, including the kinds of work we see as real work, as dignified work, as valuable and deserving of benefits and good pay. And I think that we've never seen this work as deserving. You know, we even refer to it as help, right? We don't even recognize it culturally as the profession it is for millions of women who literally pay the bills and support their families doing this work every day. And so it's very deeply ingrained. And then there's this other piece of kind of this notion of care as an individual responsibility and burden. And if you can't figure it out, it's your individual and personal failure. Like if you don't have enough money to pay for care, it's because you don't have the right job, or you didn't save, or you didn't buy the right insurance product, or, you know. And to me, that part is also very offensive because if you look around, like Paul, you're doing everything you can to take care of your dad, and your dad is doing the best he can. I mean, he's a veteran. He served this country. Like, why is it so hard for him to know that he can be cared for and age with dignity? Like, that just doesn't make any sense. And I think, just to kind of, now that I'm on my soapbox, the opportunity here is so extraordinary, because if this is the work that makes all of the work possible, but it's always been devalued and poverty wage work, if we were to invest in these jobs becoming good jobs, they would not only benefit the women and their families who do this work, but it would benefit Paul's dad, who needs these services. It would benefit Paul, who's a working family caregiver, who's stressed out trying to figure this out. It would allow Paul to go to work and do what he does in the world, knowing that his dad is in good hands. That's why there's an economist at Harvard who I love. His name's Larry Katz, and he calls care jobs triple dignity jobs, because they're enabled dignity for the workers, the people who rely on this care, and the family members who are just stressed out and pressed dealing with this issue.
I love that turn of phrase, triple dignity jobs.
And, right?
And yeah, it just shows the layers and the impact that it has. And yeah, curious, have you seen like any examples of systems, countries, governments around the world that have implemented this kind of triple dignity policy, or just kind of, you know, leveraged policy or tech in interesting ways to achieve kind of what you're talking about?
Yeah. So in Washington State, there is this extraordinary local union of home care workers, S Service Employees International Union, Local 775. And they have built all of this infrastructure that's for the workers. Like, they deployed all of their design and innovation creativity towards making these jobs better jobs in Washington State. And they've created this incredible training institution that trains 40,000 home care workers per year. It's the second largest educational institution after the University of Washington in the state. It's extraordinary. And they train workers in 12 different languages with cultural competency. And they have continuing education in rural communities for those workers to refresh their skills or upskill through pop-ups. And it's just this incredible program. And the starting salary that they've been able to negotiate for the workers is now at $18. And there's some home care workers who are earning $28, $29 an hour with retirement benefits, health care, paid time off. And those workers take so much pride in the work that they do and the services that they're able to provide. And as a result, Washington State is one of the most prepared states for the coming uptick in the need for care on the part of a growing aging population. So Washington State, I think, is like the most ready state in the country. And it's the creativity and the institution building that this union has deployed for this workforce and a state legislature and governor who really believes that this is essential.
Before moving on to the final article, four questions there is like, why is there such a bad deal for the folk on the ground level when, you know, actually care is incredibly expensive? It seems like there's a lot of companies that are making a very good profit out of this industry, but it just does not get passed down to the folk that are actually at the heart and soul of it.
Yeah, there's something about the model here, the business model, that's broken, because it just feels like the model is overcharge families and underpay workers. And that just doesn't seem like a good model. I don't know. What do you think? One problem we have is that most people don't have money to pay for care, and in general, whether it's more affordable or less affordable. In the U.S. today, 60% of the workforce earns less than $50,000 per year. And the average cost of a private room in a nursing home is $90,000 per year. And so childcare average cost is $10,000 a year. How do you afford to pay for care and food and housing and gas to get to work and care? It's just, for most people, not tenable. So we have that problem, right? And then we have the other problem that we've never invested in it. I mean, I think somebody once said, other countries have a safety net and the United States has women. You know, I don't know how you feel about the safety net in the UK. I'm sure people in the UK have complaints, but I do know that there's a little bit more support in terms of the national healthcare system and long-term care. There is no long-term care program in the US. Everybody thinks that Medicare pays for long-term care, but it doesn't. And for the one group that has a little bit more, which is veterans, it's really hard to get access to those benefits. So yeah, it's tough out here. And I don't know that the business models of the agencies, there are some agencies who are really trying to do right by families and workers, but I would say that the majority are operating in a model that's fundamentally flawed.
Yeah, it's been interesting looking at, I feel like I'm developing myself into a bit of a connoisseur of these different systems in a way, because I've looked at private system in the US where my dad is now. I've looked deeply at the veterans, you know, sort of socialized system here in the US, and looked at the UK, various systems there, both public and private, and have really started to dig into the different levels of quality and cost and things like that across those different, you know, different systems. I think there's real issues of quality. Like, you know, I think the veteran system in the US, they're trying to modernize, they're trying to update. But to your point, for folks who have, you know, served, like, I have questions about treating people who have served in the military like better than everyone else. Like, I think there's some really interesting, you know, that's a whole other conversation. But if we are to accept that as, you know, a societal value, even that, I mean, some of the institutions I've seen feel incredibly institutional, for lack of a better word. You know, they're two people to a room sharing a bathroom. They don't have private space. They can't have pets. You know, they can't have these sort of creature comforts that they've come to know their whole lives.
Yeah.
For many of them, reinstitutionalize. You know, my dad's case, he was a foster kid. So he's very sensitive to, you know, being in another institution at the end of his life, the same way he was at the beginning of his life.
You know, such a great point.
Yeah, so to do that, you know, to millions of people who have, again, served their country, I think is really problematic. But yeah, I think the you keyed in on the issue of, like, let's overcharge families, underpay workers, and then the quality suffers in the middle for the actual recipients. It's just, yeah, it's brutal.
But on the happy note, I think that historically, families who need the services and the workers who provide them have been pitted against each other in the scarcity model, right? Of like, if you want more services, we're going to have to pay workers less, kind of thing. And I think that we've finally turned the page on that dynamic where families are like, wait a minute, this makes no sense. how can somebody provide quality services if they can barely survive? They don't have enough money for food. And so I think what we saw in the last couple of years in the US was a really beautiful, powerful coming together of people with disabilities and family caregivers and veterans and their family caregivers and older people who need this care and workers, everybody together on the same page, singing from the same choir book about the need to invest in care and including the workforce and refusing to fall into this trap of false choices between services and good jobs. I think everybody knows that quality jobs result in quality care.
One of the other things that like stands out for me from like doing the research for this pod is just like this feels like it. And I feel like there's a few places that society is having this moment where it just realizes like, fuck, this is a really big problem and we've ignored it for 40 years. But like you said, we have a very aging population. There is just less money to go around if we don't solve this. If tech can't solve this problem, then it's towards the top three things that we need to solve. So yeah, it's maybe the only, and I guess hope I have that like things are getting better is it is just something that everyone is going to be affected by twice in their life, once when they have to look after their parents and then once where they get to that age themselves and need to be looked after. And yeah, the system is just so fundamentally clearly not doing the job it's intended to, that it just has to get investment, it has to get public attention, and it has to get fixed.
Yeah.
Tech has to save us. That's the new podcast episode.
No, and I think to me that feels so exciting, because most of my life as an advocate and an organizer, you're kind of like tweaking around the edges. You're just like trying to fix a little bit here, a little bit there. And our generation, we have the opportunity to do something transformational that can revolutionize how we live. Imagine if you wanted to have a baby and you knew that you would have paid time off so that you could take time off from work and not have to worry about paying the bills to spend with your newborn child. And then when you went back to work, that you would have childcare, quality childcare provided by a professional who is well compensated and able to take care of themselves and their family too. And then as that child got older, if they became ill or disabled, that you would have support to know that that child could still live a full life equal to every other child because they had the supportive services that they need. And you wouldn't have to completely give up your entire career and life to take care of them because you would have an infrastructure of support. And then as you got older, things get harder. You become more frail. You need more assistance. And there would be a trained professional whose calling it is to provide that support for you, and they would be able to tell you stories about their kids and their lives, and like that's actually possible. Well, that's not La La Land. That is actually, that could be our future, and it's so exciting that we could make that happen for future generations. But it's not inevitable. This is where tech can only save us if we save ourselves. And that's one of the reasons why we've been trying to frame this whole part of the economy as infrastructure, because people are used to thinking about infrastructure as something that you invest in and that you deploy innovation towards and that you have to maintain over time and you have to modernize. So we've been trying to say care is infrastructure. If the definition of infrastructure is everything that enables society and the economy to function, then care is like the first infrastructure we have to invest in for everything else.
Thank you. Yeah, I wanted to move us to the last piece that we shared with you, which was from the Telegraph, just a bit of a depressing one, obviously, but just curious about your perspective on, what the piece found was that there are foreign diplomats and policymakers who are engaging in this sort of behavior in terms of, abusing workers who are in their own home and not paying them well and kind of, just treating them really poorly across the board. So curious to understand a bit more about, you know, what work you've seen, you know, done and what work you're doing at your organization that have been effective at addressing this issue of, you know, even the people who are creating the policy that should be helping these folks are in their own homes treating them poorly. So yeah, what more do you think can be done, and how should that specific issue of even our leaders engaging this kind of behavior be addressed?
Yeah, I think that this is a reflection of the toxicity of inequality, that there are people who are so disenfranchised and so disempowered in our society that they are able to be tracked into servitude and kept in servitude. And in this part of the economy that no one recognizes is an actual part of the economy, an industry that no one sees as an industry, a job that no one recognizes as a job. It is the Wild West. You know, you just don't know what you're going to get. And you could find an employer who treats you really well, who you support and work for many generations. And I've heard those stories of like the nanny who takes care of the kids of the kid that they raised, you know, decades ago. Or you could find a World Bank official who traffics and enslaves domestic workers and who thinks that they should hold your passport and keep you at home working 7 days a week and keep you from going to church and make you sleep in a closet on the floor. You know, like that actually happens. That's not science fiction or a horror movie. And we've seen it happen over and over again. And then there's everything in between. And that's what happens when you have parts of the economy where the light doesn't get in. You know, people feel like they can do whatever with impunity. And impunity is so dangerous in an unequal society. So dangerous. And so that's what's happening. And that's what we have to choose. That's why the light has to come in here.
Yeah, I feel like it's very in vogue to talk about boundaries in a personal sort of mental health context these days, but, you know, expanding it to a societal context of like, look, we know how people can be, so we're going to create conditions in which, you know, they're prevented from being the worst versions of themselves who will take advantage and operate with impunity. So yeah, I appreciate that frame. I want to move us into some of the questions here just to get more background on the great work that you're doing. And the first is just, you know, just curious about the work you're doing with the National Domestic Workers Alliance. Wanted to understand the process in terms of how it got started, where it stemmed from, and particularly interested in hearing about, you know, this NDWA Labs and some of the work you're doing with La Alianza in terms of using, you know, a comprehensive data set on domestic work and chatbots.
Ooh, you did your homework.
Yeah, of course. We'd love to hear a bit about that as you're telling us the big picture story.
Yeah. The Domestic Workers Alliance was founded 15 years ago to make these jobs better jobs with dignity and respect, and to bring dignity and respect and humanity to the people who do this work. And it's mostly women, majority women of color, a lot of immigrant women, a lot of undocumented women. And it's a really challenging workforce to solve for, because a lot of the work happens in the shadows. A lot of the workforce is working without authorization to work as an undocumented person. And there's this long history of exclusion from labor laws that we've talked about. And then there's also this structural dynamic where the workers are disaggregated in millions of homes around the country, where you could go into any neighborhood and not know which of these homes are also workplaces. So how do you raise standards or enforce standards in that context? You don't even know where people are working. It's just completely invisible. It's the most visible, invisible workforce. So we not only have to solve for the structural, legal, and systematic exclusions from laws, we have to deal with the racism and sexism embedded in our culture that devalues this work. But we also have to figure out that problem of everybody being hidden behind closed doors, isolated, one person per workplace. And how do we establish norms in that context and enforce them? And so we started about 12 years ago to see that technology companies like Care.com and Sittercity and Urban Sitter and Handy and all these platforms started to create the Uber of this, or the Uber of care, or the Uber of cleaning. And we started to realize that these companies were actually aggregating our workforce in unprecedented ways, and that there might be an opportunity to leverage the power of technology here for our purposes of improving jobs and organizing workers. And so we created NDWA Labs. I recruited this brilliant leader named Pollock Shaw, who is our director of social innovation. And she built the lab as an incubator for technology solutions and partnerships with technology companies to create good jobs and to organize workers. And one of the first things that we built was a portable benefits product that would allow for house cleaners who have multiple clients to each contribute a little bit on a prorated basis into a benefits account that the worker could just decide what benefit she wanted to deploy the funds in her account towards. And it was a way of somebody who has lots of clients and no access to a safety net for them to actually start to accrue some benefits. And ultimately, we went through lots of iterations, but part of the experimentation of that, we happened upon a tool that is now become this incredible communication platform that we have with about 240,000 Spanish-speaking domestic workers called La Alianza. It's basically a chatbot that enables us to talk to workers that we've never been able to find or talk to before. And through the pandemic, it was such a lifeline because we were able to survey thousands of workers every week about how they were faring in the pandemic, if they had access to PPE, if they were worried about housing insecurity, food insecurity, if they were losing their jobs. I mean, we had our finger on the pulse of one of the most invisible and hard to reach groups of workers in our economy through the greatest crisis that our country has faced in a long time. And it's powerful. And it's through the Alia product that we built and through the experimentation that allowed us to build this messenger chatbot that we were able to deliver emergency cash assistance to domestic workers who were impacted by COVID. We distributed $31 million to over 55,000 domestic workers in the height of the pandemic because we knew that other forms of government relief and aid would not reach them.
That's powerful. It's like a massive mutual aid society you built, in a way. And shame on the U.S. government for sending out $600 checks to people who, they knew needed much, much more, at that time. So, thank you for doing that. And be curious to hear, I'm sure there were, millions of success stories that came out of that, but just curious to hear success stories that you've seen, out of your work at the National Domestic Workers Alliance. What have been some of your favorites?
Well, one that we think is really exciting is the cash assistance product. So we had this kind of benefits platform that we had built internally in the labs, and we used the kind of bones of that to adapt it into a cash assistance product called Alia Cares in the pandemic. And we knew we wouldn't have the capacity to build that product quick enough. So we called our friends at Google Foundation, google.org, and they deployed a team of engineers to work full time with us for 6 months under the direction of our innovation director and as a part of our labs team. And we were able to build a world-class technology product to deliver this cash assistance to domestic workers. And we were able to help cities around the country who were trying to figure out how to get emergency assistance to vulnerable populations, especially immigrant workers. So we consulted with over a dozen cities on how to do their emergency assistance programs, and a few of them even used our product. Our product has now been open sourced, so any city can actually use it to deliver emergency assistance in a crisis, whether it's a climate disaster or a pandemic. But it's a really beautiful coming together of philanthropy and individuals who are caring and wanted to donate to help domestic workers in this time of crisis. A technology company and their foundation really coming in and working with a social movement to actually rise to the occasion of a crisis. We were able to meet the greatest need of our workers at their time of greatest need because of that coming together. And it's a time that, you know, technology was deployed for good in such a powerful way. And so we look for those moments and those opportunities where we can create the context for technology to be deployed in powerful ways for good and for justice.
Just wondering, like some of the recent much talked about sort of technological advancements have been around generative AI and sort of machine learning. I mean, and it sounds like you are right at the cutting edge of tech and what you're using it for. Just wondering if you have any sort of future plans based on that or are already deploying them. Like obviously I imagine the chatbot uses some form of AI.
So that's the one way we're already using it. And I think that there are a lot of organizing opportunities where, you know, I do think the kind of one-on-one, which is one of the first things that organizers are trained in, you know, is like how to have a deep and meaningful conversation with somebody to understand their hopes and their aspirations and their challenges and what will be required to unleash the power of their voice. I do think that that kind of interaction is irreplaceable, but there's a lot in between that and organizing masses of people for social change that I do think AI can be deployed for in really helpful ways. And I think the key here is really, you know, what we started the conversation with, which is to what end? And also, how are we designing not only for really positive outcomes, for justice, for equity, for humanity, but also how are we designing for the risks and ensuring that some of these tools are not being deployed in ways that are just way beyond even human and policy kind of control. And so, yeah, like I feel like that whole space is such a wild west. And there's some of us who are in there trying to figure out, okay, what are the opportunities? But there's this much larger question of, in the end, what is best for humanity?
Curious to hear a bit more about your personal journey, sort of how did you land at being the, you know, the president of the National Domestic Workers Alliance and the director of Caring Across Generations? What unique perspectives and background are you bringing to those roles?
It's so funny because I'm always asked this question and I've probably answered it 10 different ways. And the truth is, I have no idea how I ended up here. I just consider myself incredibly lucky to have found myself in a spot where I get up every day and serve an incredibly powerful and important group of people to do really important work. And it just feels like so clear that it needs to happen, and it's so fun and exciting and meaningful to be able to contribute to it. And I guess it's been that way for a long time, so it just kind of stuck with it. Sorry if that's not very satisfying. I don't have a great personal story.
No worries at all. And sort of just rounding us off here, you've been on a heck of a journey already in your industry. Like what would you say has been sort of one of the biggest frustrations for you about your sector, about your space? Obviously we touched upon a few already, but what's kind of the biggest concern about the industry?
Honestly, my frustration is what it always has been, which is the fact that the women who do this work incredibly hard and do work that is so essential and still can barely survive. The fact that average wages are $12 an hour and that you can make more in a fast food job than doing care. I mean, nothing against fast food at all. It's more just kind of like, how do we still have jobs where people can't survive, where people are working incredibly hard and still cannot feed their families? How? And why are so many of those jobs held by women and people of color, who are like at the center of our families and our communities? It's just enraging that this is where we are when we've like taken people to the moon and we are capable of like building nuclear things and I don't know, all these crazy things, but we can't fix this. That's my greatest frustration.
That's a good one, to be fair.
Yeah, that's a good one. And you mentioned a couple of times like the focus on women here, and Will and I are very conscious that we were two dudes on a tech podcast talking about tech, and you know, like, but looking through your website, like your spokespersons and your board, there is a noticeable lack of men, right? And not that they need to deserve to be there, but just curious, like, what do you think is the proper role for men in this movement? Like, what should the men who are listening to this podcast step up and do to get involved and play, you know, a vital and important role? Like, yeah, what's sort of your message? Like, how do we, you know, engage with the movement? How do we join it?
Well, you're a really important part of the future of this movement. I think when men join this movement in droves is when we win, honestly. And when men do this work of care work is when these jobs become good jobs. I mean, I just think it's like it then takes it out of this kind of niche interest. And I don't know why women's concerns and priorities and jobs are still considered a special interest, but because we're like a majority of the population. But it is the reality. And the other truth here is that, Paul, there's so many men who are in your position that 36% of all family caregivers are men. And this is where sexism hurts men too. Like the sexism that has devalued this work and made it so unsupported is hurting the 36% of men who are in this position, who are even more invisible. And millennial men who are having babies are playing so much more of a role in their kids' lives than ever any generation ahead of them. And so I just think the expectations are in some ways that men are going to be involved in care much more. And so like, let's really be involved and let's own it. And a lot of these jobs are going to be the jobs of the future. And they're jobs that require strength and tenacity and endurance. And I think because they're associated with women, they're seen as soft or something like nursing. And we have to shift that. Like these are jobs that have incredible value and meaning. And I think they should be ones that men want to go into. And I think when we start to shift all of that kind of those deeply held cultural norms and beliefs about the role of men, the role of women, and everybody just gets on the care train, I think a lot of things will get better. And yeah, I think it's also like you telling your story, Paul, about what you're doing with your dad. That's part of it. You're on the care train.
Yeah, I was gonna say, I love the idea of the care train, the visual that just popped in my head was powerful. And yeah, I appreciate what you're saying there too about, I've definitely had to grapple with that, like my own sense of my own masculinity and hyper-masculinity and all that stuff around like, am I a carer? How am I a carer? You know, I think I started very resistant to like, I'm not, you know, a physical caregiver or, you know, all that stuff, and have had to really shed some of that and grapple with some of it. So
appreciate you saying,
Yeah.
And to men out there, it's like, it's really hot. Like being a caregiver is the thing. It's awesome.
Yeah. Yeah. I like telling men, it's, you know, they will be more attractive as a vehicle to get them interested in care. That's one way. I think we'll use whatever tool in our,
whatever it takes.
Our tool belt, as it were. Cool. I want to move us into the lightning round here. And this is just like kind of quick hit questions to kind of get to know you on a bit more of a fun, cheeky level. And the first question is just around tech. Like, you know, what is a game changing tech product in your life that helps you do all the amazing work that you do?
WhatsApp. Our members are on WhatsApp like crazy. And I get the cutest little memes with animations, and it's really amazing. And it's like a globally used, you know, immigrants of all kinds of communities are on WhatsApp. And so it's kind of this connector app. And then in my personal life, the New York Times cooking app is my go-to. It's literally to help me survive the pandemic.
And this might be the first time we've ever had a cooking-based answer. So yeah, thank you. Thank you for that.
Yeah, we actually just upgraded our New York Times account for our team so that they could have cooking. I think we did it right around Thanksgiving last year or something like that. So hopefully our team's getting good use of that. And
You will not regret it.
Definitely be checking that out. What's one problem tech can't solve for us and why?
Tech can't solve care alone. We need government. We need caregivers. We need everybody. It's an all hands on deck situation. Tech can make parts of the caregiving experience better, which is really important, but it can't solve it.
Do you worry about that as well? Do you think we'll see the advent of like caregiving robots that will displace, you know, millions of caregivers' jobs?
You know, Pollack actually led a whole process with a group of our members, our worker council leaders, on this question of AI. Good for us, bad for us, robots, caregiving robots. How do we feel? And the workers actually were so clear. They were excited about some of the developments and some of the ways in which robotics and AI could make aspects of their jobs easier so that they could focus on the parts of their jobs that only humans can do that are actually the most valuable, the most important parts that are about human-to-human connection, helping to combat loneliness, helping to enhance well-being, you know, all of these things that are about a human connection. And so they were excited about some of these developments and not at all threatened. And I guess it's like when you know your worth, you know?
Yeah, that's really interesting to hear, and very different than like the jitters that have gone across the marketing industry around ChatGPT and writers and designers, you know, worried about their jobs and stuff like that. Yeah, I mean, that's a powerful statement of their value in the care profession, that they get it. You know, they're not going to be replaced anytime soon by a robot. So,
and by the way, they're still trying to figure out how to design a robot that can fold a towel. So it's going to be a minute.
Yes. Wow. I put it in perspective. Well, yeah, sort of taking a question in a different direction here. This is our tech for bad question. What's the evilest application of tech that you've seen out there?
Misinformation. The way that misinformation and disinformation have proliferated on social channels, I think it's the greatest threat to democracies around the world and to humanity, ultimately.
Yeah, I've definitely seen it with the elderly. I've seen my dad's been a victim of the, you know, like scams, like, which I just cannot believe that people are out there scamming elderly people in that way. Have you seen it, misinformation creep its way into, you know, care workers and affect care workers that you work with in any way?
I mean, everybody is getting inundated with lies. And even ChatGPT, I mean, I think it's maybe better now, but like if you ask it questions, it very confidently will lie. It's like polling data, but there's no vetting for truth and accuracy. So I think it's like, yeah, I think that there's a lot that is out there that is spreading a distrust in institutions and leadership and, yeah, in each other that is actually quite dangerous.
Definitely agree with that. You've already dreamt up a couple of incredible tech products or worked to build them. If tomorrow you could sort of wave a magic wand and create a new tech product, what problem would it solve and for whom?
Well, we're actually building this now, but we want to build an app for domestic workers that's like a place where they can get connected to other workers and like kind of like a peer support infrastructure, but that also where they can get connected to benefits or and resources and, you know, all kinds of tools that everything from advocacy tools to day-to-day things that they would need, like, I don't know, registering to vote or finding out what benefits they're eligible for or what are their occupational health and safety rights in the state that they live in, things like that. So kind of like a one-stop shop that's really designed with domestic workers' lives and needs in mind in a way that's never been done before.
And one question I always like to ask is about predictions, and you're talking to, you know, hundreds, thousands maybe of domestic workers, you know, every year, care workers as well. Any predictions you have for that space and as it relates to tech in the coming year or so?
So I would love for tech to join us in saying that these are a big share of the jobs of the future and we should make them good jobs, and that people in tech are also people who have families who need care, and that a strong care infrastructure also supports tech. And that's what we're going to need. Our campaign that's just kicked off this month, I don't know if you realize this, but this month of April has been officially declared by the White House Care Worker Recognition Month for the first time in history. Nice. And next week, we'll be gathering hundreds of care workers from across the care economy, child care, early childhood, aging, disability care, nursing homes, homes, everywhere, in one place in DC to have a summit, just declaring the value of these jobs and insisting on investments that make them good jobs. And it's going to be historic. We cannot wait. And we're putting a stake in the ground. The care economy is the future. We've got to invest in it as if it's so. And these jobs have to become good jobs. And we're going to spend the next 2 years organizing to make that happen so that in 2025, we'll hopefully get another opportunity to make a big investment in our workforce. And in that moment, we want care to come first.
That's awesome. Congratulations on the first ever official Caregivers Month.
Thank you. I know it feels so big, you know, from invisibility to getting our own special month.
Yeah. Well, we always like to round things off on a positive note. So would love to hear what's worked well for you in terms of building a career in tech that sort of, you know, balances profit and you know, being able to pay the bills, but also with it with an incredible purpose and an incredible mission that you've spent an hour talking to us about that we all believe in.
Oh, you know, I don't consider myself as in tech. I consider myself as like knowing just enough to be dangerous. But my colleague, Pollock Shaw, she's really taught me everything that I know. And she has figured out a way for a social movement of low wage, invisible workers to harness the power of technology. And we're just getting started. I mean, there's so much more that I think we can do to leverage the power of technology to make life better for the women who do the work in our homes that makes everything else possible. And so I think it's kind of like when you're grounded in real people's lives and experiences, and you're designing for, in some ways, the people who are hardest to solve for, right? Not the low-hanging fruit. Come on, tech. Like, let's not do the low-hanging fruit anymore. Like, let's actually go for the stuff that's hard. And the people who everybody's written off as the hardest to design for, what if we started there? What else might be possible? That's kind of the ethic that we bring to our work, not just with tech, but with everything. And I think it means that we build solutions that are better, that are more durable and more inclusive.
Well, thank you for that. I think we'll wrap up there. This has been another fantastic episode of Tech Can't Save Us with wonderful guests, Aijen Poo, president of the National Domestic Workers Alliance and director of Caring Across Generations. We've covered everything from the great work they're doing with La Alianza and pulling together impressive data sets to better understand what's happening with care workers and their labs project and the chatbot that they've built or they're in the process of building. The amazing work that they're doing across the nation, across the U.S. for care workers and domestic workers. So, Aijen, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me. This has been fun.
And where can folks find out more about the National Domestic Workers Alliance and Caring Across Generations and your great work?
Domesticworkers.org and caringacross.org.
Amazing. We'll be sure to include those links in the episode description. And again, we know you're very busy with the incredible mission of both those organizations. So yeah, just thank you for taking the time to jump on the pod today. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.